I've got, just realised I've got a dog hair all over my black thing. Anyway, there we go. Such is life. I got up quite early this morning. And I didn't check my top. So, my name is Jenny Peters. We had to try and remember how to spell the church that we're at, Bryanston. But anyway, I had to write it down. It wasn't very clever, but there we go. I work for the church, and I run a centre for families, really looking at sort of the earliest relationships we have. So working with mums with babies 0 to 3, and then also doing stuff in terms of couple relationships, marriage relationships, and we do a lot with our local area, etc., etc. So I'm going to talk a bit about that later, but that's just in case you wanted to follow me. I actually need more Twitter followers than my husband, who is currently stuck on 666. How bad is that for a church leader? Anyway, when people join, other people stop following him just to annoy him. Anyway, there we go. Good. Can we have a next one? I can't remember what I put. Oh, there are my children. You know, because you like to know where people come from, don't you? There's my children. There's the cause of my dog hairs, which is Jake. That was the Christmas one. Next one. And that's John. And then you can take it down one more. Isn't that delightful? Okay, good. So what I felt it would be good to talk about today was the theme of hand in hand. And I want to think about sort of two bits of that. Firstly, hand in hand with God, and then hand in hand with other people, if that's okay. If it isn't, that's tough, because that's what I'm doing. So when you think about the phrase hand in hand, I don't know what it kind of means to you. Hands, I just think hands are incredible. They're really, and if you've ever sort of injured your hand or anything, you actually realize just how much you do with them and how sort of symbolic they are in terms of when we meet people or when we greet people or what does it mean to shake someone by the hand. I went to, Downing Street about 2 years ago, which I don't normally do, just to let you know, but they did some kind of sort of Christmas thing for church leaders, and I happened to know the person who was compiling the list anyway, so he put me on the list because we weren't really, so there was all these like really significant church leaders, and then there was us, but there we were, wandering around Downing Street, as you do. And it was when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, so it's actually quite a long time ago. So how long ago? We're talking 6 years, probably. And I happen to be a member of the Labour Party, not that that's relevant at all to this talk, apart from to say that I wanted to shake Gordon Brown's hand, because I was like, I've paid into this party for a long time. I'm pretty sure most of the others haven't. And, you know, I'm going to meet you. So what they do is, in these things, you... maybe my ears are the wrong size. Okay, sorry, it's annoying, isn't it? There we go. There. You go into this room, you're really excited because you think you're going to meet the Prime Minister, and then you have literally no chance because there's 400 other people trying to do exactly the same thing. So I'm with Mark Meluish at the time, and we decide that we are going to meet him. So we will do whatever it takes to actually shake this man by the hand. And so we're basically like scurrying around the room, trying to get in line that when he comes, you know, down a sweep of people, we'll get to shake his hand. So fantastically, because we're very dedicated, we line up and we manage to just kind of sweep in just as he's walking past us. So I get to shake his hand, very exciting. And so that was all very nice. And he said something like, thanks for all your work. And I say, it's a pleasure. It was deep, very meaningful. And then I'm just, so now my life's purpose is fulfilled and I can just enjoy the rest of the party. And so I'm just chatting to someone and I suddenly realize the talks are about to start. Well, the speech is about to start. And then I realized that literally I'm standing there and Gordon Brown is standing there, and I hadn't really noticed that I was that near to the microphone. So I think I'll shift over this way just to like get slightly out of the view of everyone. I've got a massive table behind me with this really ornate sort of vase on the back, so I can't go backwards. Then I look and there's this tiny, petite, lovely little lady to the other side. So I can't, unless I push her out the way, I also can't, I might have to do the handheld because I think this might be just annoying for all of you. Sorry, otherwise I was just going to fiddle all day. That would be really irritating to watch. Where was I? Little lady to my left-hand side. So I can't push the little lady out the way because that would look rude. So I'm literally stuck there. And then Gordon Brown comes to the microphone, and now I realise I am really, really close to him. In fact, I am so close that when he steps back, which he does, I don't know why, he steps slightly back from the microphone, I end up with my hand touching his bottom. Yeah, so anyway, so he shoots round, and I don't know what to do. I'm like, I'm so sorry, Prime Minister. I'm just absolutely puce. And because I've now not only shook his hand, but touched his bottom, which is not really what you want to do. And I'm stuck for the entire speech, standing as if I'm married to him, bright red. And there's pictures of me at the event, literally puce red. And a bishop actually came up to me at the end and said, "Oh, you know, how long have you worked for Gordon Brown?" I was like, no, I don't work for him. Anyway, that's always what makes me think about hand in hand, hand in bottom. And, you know, all kinds of greeting things. I wonder if he remembers. I'm sure he doesn't. Okay, so we say lots of different things by our hands. We say, "Hello, Prime Minister." We say, "I'm with you." You know, when you're going, if you're having, you know, a really difficult time and you're going into something which you know is going to be quite stressful, it is nice to hold someone's hand. They say, "I'm with you. I'm here for you. I'm present with you." When we're trying to be brave, sometimes we go and we like to hold people's hands. When back in the day, when I was a child, you know, a boy holding your hand was the first sign that you actually might like you. It's all changed now, apparently, according to my children. And I know nothing because I grew up in Surrey. And you would also be including that because you've grown up in Kent. So basically, apparently, only people who've grown up in London know anything about life, according to my three children, who are teenagers. No, I don't mean you know nothing about life. I'm just saying that. There's an image. If you click through, here we go. This is going on adventures together. The next one is quite a famous image during an operation of a 21-week-old baby, and they were operating in utero. And as they were operating, the surgeon, his finger was put very near the fetus's, the baby's hand, and the baby held on to his finger and just actually squeezed the finger. So it's quite a powerful, and this is a 21-week-old baby. So it's been used a lot, and it's slightly a contentious image actually, but it's a powerful sign of connection. And the surgeon said it was an incredible experience, because that wasn't what, you know, that wasn't the mode he was in. Okay, next one. So I think a hand is a sign of basic connection. It's how we connect with people. And when I was thinking about today, I was thinking that we really need, in order to function well as Christians, we need to hold two people's or two beings' hands. We need to put our hand in the hand of God, and we need to learn what that looks like in our lives, and then we need to put our hand in the hands of other people. And that basically, if you had to summarize discipleship, is probably as good as it gets. If we can learn to walk with God and we can learn to walk with other people, then that's kind of the journey that we should be on. We have we've been thinking a lot about what discipleship looks like in our church, and we have a lot of 18 to 30s in our church. We've been quite good, we say modestly, at actually converting them. We are less good at discipling them. And so we've been thinking a lot about what it looks like, and this is sort of, if you could boil it down to what is the essence of discipleship, and there's lots of different parts of discipleship, but the essence is, I think, learning to walk hand in hand with God, whatever stage we're in, and it doesn't matter, and learning to walk hand in hand with other people. So I'm going to start with God, because it's always good to start with God. I do lots of work with children, and the answer is always Jesus. So we know, don't we, that we're called to walk hand in hand with God, who made us, shaped us, and died for us. I'm going to read a very familiar passage. If you have Bibles, you can get them out too. Yes. Actually, I can read it here. You know, I forgot my glasses today. If anyone's got 0.75 glasses, it might be quite useful. Anyway, it's fine. I can read it off there. And this is about the call of the disciples. And I don't know about you, but do you sometimes think, if only that person would become a Christian, they'd be amazing. So a person, and normally when we think about that sort of person, I think we often think that they might be, got it all together, they're really nice, they're really personable, you know, they're people we really like. And, you know, if God got hold of them, just imagine what he could do, it'd be amazing. We have Paul McCartney, I don't know why he came into our church, he literally came in for something. And someone went up to him and said, thank you for all your music. Slightly embarrassing. Eric Clapton came to another church we were in, and someone went up to him and said, oh, it's nice to meet you after all this time. Anyway, but I think we sometimes put on to, if famous people became Christians, that would be incredible. And actually, it rarely works like that, does it? It just, God doesn't seem to pick famous, you know, incredibly charismatic or beautiful people. He picks people like us. And that's the kind of people he specializes in, which is just as well for us. So, I don't see that in a Reed way. Was that Reed? No. You hate me now. No, you don't really. Okay, so I'm just going to read the call of the first disciples. After John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee, and this is Mark 1, proclaiming the good news of God. The time has come, he said, the kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I will make you fishers of men. At once they left their nets and followed him. And I know that that is a very, very familiar passage to us all. And, you know, so I often think about what was it? How did Jesus pick the people that he picked? He could have picked anyone. He could have picked lots of people. So what was it? What did he see in those people for the ones that he went up to and said, come follow me? What was it? How did he do it? Because it'd be quite useful, wouldn't it, to have a honing skill like that. And actually, what we know from the very fact that they were fishermen was that Jesus did not pick the cleverest, the most esteemed, the people that everyone would think if they were a Christian, that would be great. Because we know that we are in Orthodox Galilee at the time, and we're in the first century, we're around about, you know, whatever. I can never remember how the BC and AD works, but we're just about the turn. And at that time, there were three main sort of levels of education. So there was level one, Betz Affair. We might want to flip that up, actually. There we go. And that was the house of the book. So the Bible, or the Torah, was incredibly important. And education was actually incredibly important. And so if you were a first century Jew, you would have gone in, a male, you would have gone in and you would have done your learning. And everyone would have gone to the level one, which means that by the time you were 10, you would have the entire Torah, the first five books of the Bible, memorized. Nice. Quite impressive, actually. So, and that was just the basic sort of primary school level. Key stage two, maybe. Don't know. Probably key stage two. And then for people who, then the next stage up was Bet Talmud, the house of learning. And students who were more gifted, so some people would drop out after that stage. You know, you knew the basics. Off you go. Join a profession. Join in with what your family did. Those people who were a little bit more sort of able to grasp some of the stuff would go to the house of learning. And then they would continue their education. It would last until about the age of 14. And by the age of 13 or 14, the top students would have the entire Bible, that is the Old Testament, memorized. Genesis through Malachi. And those who didn't make the cut would then go back to their families, and they would become things like fishermen or carpenters or whatever it was. And the very gifted scholars would go on to the final level, Midrash, the house of study. And this is where it begins to get really serious. And to do this, you'd have to basically sort of apply to become a disciple. And you'd have a rabbi would pick you and choose you and say the famous words, come follow me. And those would be the top of the top, the cleverest of the clever, the people that rabbis would bother spending their time with. Because to be frank, it wasn't worth spending time with the other people because they'd already not made the grade. So, you know, the rabbis of the day would have chosen, and they would have gone up to students there, and they would have said, come follow me. And then they would be expected to leave who they were and what they had, and they would expect to become a disciple. Sounds familiar. And this is, you know, the rabbis would generally pick from this level. And yet what Jesus did is he picked from people who'd already dropped out in levels one and two. So we don't know how far Peter got. We don't know how far James got. We don't know how far any of them got. But we do know that they hadn't really ultimately made the grade because they were fishermen. So we know that. We know that to be true. And he didn't go for the elite. He didn't go for the top scholars. He didn't go for people who could help unpack the Bible for him. He went for the ordinary people who were just going about life. And what did he see in them? Well, we don't know. But I imagine he saw in them, he saw their heart, he saw who they were, he saw the kind of people, not only that they were, but the kind of people that they could maybe become. And he picked the ones society had rejected. He didn't care about what was in their head. He cared about what was in their heart. He took the ordinary and he chose to make them extraordinary. They didn't come in their own merit. Their sole sort of qualification was that they responded to Jesus and they were prepared to walk with him. Now, I know, I'm hoping this doesn't come as a shock to you, but we weren't chosen to be Christians because we were the clever ones or the wise ones or the impressive ones or the ones who had it all together. We were picked as, you know, the slightly weak and foolish ones because God knows, and we're the ones who respond, and I know it's both, because God looks into our heart and he chooses and we then respond. And, you know, so when we think like we have to have it all together, I want you to think back to the moment that you first responded to God. Did you have it all together then? Well, maybe you did. I definitely didn't. And that's the point at which God saw us and chose us. And there is, you know, we know this, don't we? But there is no other qualification other than choosing to follow him. So you don't have to look big or talk big or think big or be impressive or impress lots of other people, because Jesus knows exactly who we are and he knows exactly what we're like. If we can click on to the next one. Yes, okay. So I became a Christian at the age of 8 at Pathfinder Camp, or is it Explorer Camp? Anyway, one of the two. Did you do Explorers or Pathfinders? Very old. So I was aged 8 and we happened to go to our local church. My parents were sort of church goers, but I think they'd have gone anywhere really. You know, in the sense of you kind of went along to church, that's sort of what you did. And then they, every year, they did this camp for sort of 8, 9-year-olds. And you did all the normal things, you know, wide games, trips to wherever, lots of fun, and then talks in the evening. And I think on the last evening, and I don't know who gave the talk, but I can still remember the talk. It was about choosing to follow Jesus. And I thought, well, I definitely want to do that. You know, why would I want to be left out? It was a very visual image. I definitely want to follow Jesus with my life, but I'm only 8, so I'm quite little. So, so I pray the prayer and I'm walking home with a friend of mine who also was on the camp, but decided not to pray the prayer because she wasn't sure that she'd be able to get to church. And we didn't really know what to do about that because, you know, it was a bit difficult because her parents weren't Christians and, you know, the wisdom that we had at 8 was very minuscule. And so she decided she wouldn't pray the prayer. And it's actually, sadly, not a Christian yet. But anyway, she may be. And but I knew that I wanted to follow Jesus. If God existed, and I'd always kind of known that God existed, then who wouldn't want a relationship with him? Definitely wanted it. But so my first ministry was my sticker ministry. See these nice little stickers up there? And I used to buy little sheets of stickers, as you could do in, like, bookshops and stuff. And I'd stick them on lampposts in our area as a way of trying to share the good news of Jesus in a very annoying way. I didn't know it was annoying, but it probably was really, really annoying for everyone else. So I would stick, you know, smile, Jesus loves you stickers, and as I walked down the road and prayed. And that was the level of my ministry, age 8. Didn't do much else apart from that. And then when we became teenagers, we rebelled by becoming charismatics, which is really fun. And our parents pretended to be deeply shocked. I'm sure they were absolutely ecstatic, actually. So we would go along to Gerald Coates' church, which is, what is it? What's it called? New Frontiers? Pioneer. And we would go and be prayed for, and people would lay hands on us and fill us with this, you know, pray that the Spirit would come and fill us. And then, you know, we'd have a great time, and then we'd all go home, and we spent our time having prayer meetings and, you know, doing all kinds of deeply intense stuff as teenagers are wont to do. But actually quite good stuff, really, and quite healthy and really not as destructive as quite a lot of the other stuff that we could be doing. But I remember going up to one of the people who was praying at the front and saying, I said, I need to be filled with the Spirit. And she said, is this the first time? I said, no, but he keeps draining away. And every time I go, it just feels like, you know, there's a hole. And I would continually also sort of pray the prayer in the sense of feeling like Jesus probably couldn't have heard me the first time around, you know, because I was very little. And so I would do it and do it and do it. And then eventually someone said to me, I think it's done. You know, I think you can probably count yourself in, which is a great relief, can I say? But I still have a little bit of a fear about the rapture. Does anyone else have a fear about the rapture? I do. And so occasionally if I go into the office and no one at the church office and no one else is there, I think, oh, no, it happened. Darn it, I got left behind. There's a terrible song when I was growing up called I Wish We'd All Been Ready. And I think that is the basis on which my anxiety about the rapture is based. Larry Norman. It's a terrible song. Thanks. Can't do it with one hand. Yes, the Larry Norman song is like two people walking along a street and then one disappears. I wish they'd all been ready. It's very scary. But you'll be pleased to know, in case you are worried about it and you have pets, that there is a website that was honestly existed in the States, because me and my friend found it, which is called something like Pets After the Rapture. And what you can do is you can sign your pet up with a non-Christian family who aren't going to be raptured because they're not Christians. So then if you're raptured, your pets get looked after. Perfect. Honestly, I can't remember the exact website, but we found it. It was deeply funny. I just love that. How could you recruit that? How could you recruit people? Well, at the end of the world, you know, you're going to live in death and destruction zone, but we just need people to look after our pets. Anyway, I don't know. I don't think it really lasted. I don't think it hugely took on. So God picks us not for who we are, but he picks us for who he knows that we can become. I've got a clip now, which is from a French film. I'm so arty, which actually someone found for me, which is called The Classroom. Is it the next one on? Oh, keep going. Okay. Sorry. Stop one sec. Can we stop it for one sec? Okay. So I'm just going to give you the background. So the background is it's in a very tough school in France. And I want you to think about the teacher. And he's asking the class what they've learnt. So he's been now teaching them for a whole year. And he wants to try and discover from them what they've learned. And if you don't follow French perfectly, there are subtitles. Okay, go.
Moi, j'ai rien appris, moi.
On peut pas avoir passé 9 mois à l'école sans avoir rien appris. Ça, c'est pas possible.
Bah si, la preuve. J'ai rien appris.
Dans les livres qu'on a lus, t'en as bien tiré quelque chose.
Ils sont chers, vos livres, monsieur.
Ils sont quoi?
Ils sont nuls.
Et un des livres que tu aurais lu pour toi, par exemple.
Des livres comme je dis. Si, il y a La République. Le livre de La République.
La République de Platon.
Ouais.
T'as lu ça? Mais comment ça se fait que t'as lu ça?
Bah, c'est ma grande sœur qui l'a vu.
Elle fait de la philo, ta grande sœur?
Non, elle fait du droit.
Mais alors, vas-y, raconte-nous, c'est quoi ce livre?
Bah, en fait, il y a un gars là, comment il s'appelle déjà?
Il s'appelle Socrate.
Ouais, Socrate. Ben, un gars il vient, il accoste les gens dans la rue et tout, il leur dit ouais, est-ce que t'es sûr de penser ce que tu penses? Est-ce que t'es sûr de faire ce que tu fais? Tout ça. Après, ben, les gens ils savent plus les insons et tout, ils se posent des questions. Mais il est trop fort.
Mais alors, quel genre de questions il pose? Sur quel sujet?
Surtout. C'est sur l'amour, sur la religion, sur Dieu, sur les gens, surtout.
Mais c'est très bien que tu aies lu ça.
Ouais, je sais. C'est pas un livre de pétasse, hein.
Okay, so if could everyone read it at the back? Okay, oh, I'm sorry. But your French was fine, right? Basically, what he was saying, what have you learned? She said, I've learned nothing. And he, instead of getting cross with her, which is probably the genius of this teacher, is he just explores it with her. He doesn't say, well, you've been sitting in my class, how rude. He says, really, you've learned nothing over 9 months. No books you've read. How about book? No, nothing. Your books are you rubbish, she says. And again, he doesn't take her on at her aggression. He just chooses to go, okay, well, what about books you read outside school? And in the conversation, finds out that she's read The Republic by Plato. And she's able, so she's read the entire book, and she's able to basically give him a synopsis of the book and really have quite a very good understanding of what is quite a complex book and a complex sort of theory, I suppose. And she says at the end, it's not a skank's book. You know, it's just like, you know, you could look at this child and think, you are useless. You know, you're honestly telling me you learnt nothing at school. But because he has the conversation, And he explores it with her. And he discovers this is this sort of untapped depth, which you would never have looked, which you'd never looked or seen on the surface. And I think it's, you know, I think it's a very similar thing with Jesus. He looks at these rough and ready fishermen. He gets tax collectors. And he doesn't look at what's on the outside. He sees what, you know, the untapped potential, which is there. And he sees beyond what everyone else sees. He knows what you're going to become. There's another clip, which I couldn't get to work for some reason, but it's called Educating the East End, in which this child has managed to... They're not allowed mobile phones in school. So he's taken a book, and he's managed to cut out a space in the book and hidden his phone inside it. Genius! Now, you could either say... You know, that is a terrible abuse of school property. Or you could say, that is a clever child. See, he has a problem, which is, I want to be on my phone and I want to be in school. And he basically works out a solution. Genius. You know, so, you know, good teachers might well take that and go, you know, how can we use this untapped potential of, like, sheer evil genius and turn it to good? Because, you know, you are a clever kid. Now, I don't know about you, but I have a particular soft spot for Peter. I know Paul was really impressive, and I know he did some really good theology, and you might get converted by Paul, but you probably wouldn't actually want to hang out with him too much, because I just think he'd be quite irritating. Sorry. When I get to heaven, I've said this a few times, I'll probably be, like, living next to him or something. No, I wouldn't be living next to him. I wouldn't be anywhere near him. But Peter's the sort of person, because he's just so larger than life, mistakes sort of written for everyone to see. He's the sort of person we can identify with a little bit more, do you think? Or I can identify with a bit more, because I'm a little bit like that. So he stops everything. There he is. He's in a fishing boat. Stops everything. No hesitation. No prevarication. No, can I just try and sort this out? Can I pray about it? I want to think if it sits right with me, etc., etc. He just sees Jesus and he responds. He leaves everything and he follows him. He lets go of his fishing nets. So he lets go of his family. He lets go of his livelihood. He lets go of his tradition. And he follows this rabbi. Or he follows Jesus, and he leaves everything, and he turns, and he goes and follows him, and he puts his hand in the hand of Jesus. Now, I'm not sure that Peter understood a lot of the next 3 years that happened to him. So if you read through the Gospel of Mark, you know, it's an absolute roller coaster for Peter. I don't think he really got very much of it at all. I think he pretty much held hold of Jesus' hand and just knew that he just needed to keep holding on. And the rest of it kind of came and went in terms of understanding, but if he could just hold on, he might be okay. When I was 14, I went on an adventure holiday, as you do, and the year before, I'd also gone on the same kind of thing, because they did it every year at our school, and we'd done water skiing. And weirdly, because I wasn't particularly good at sport, but I was actually quite good at water skiing also, I thought. And so I managed to stand up and, like, whiz around the lake on, you know, behind the boat, bump, 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 bump. And so the next year, it's a big group of teenagers, and they say, can anyone volunteer and show people how to water ski? So I'm like, actually, I can. Because you know what? Don't want to brag, but I'm pretty good at water skiing. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened in the interim, but I just couldn't even stand up. So I'm there like this, and I'm holding on, but I can't, for some reason, I can't get the strength in my legs. I don't know if you've ever done water skiing. It's actually quite difficult to actually stand up. So all I end up doing is bump on my bottom, which is really painful, all the way around the lake, with everybody laughing at me. It was a humiliating experience. And water's quite hard when you hit it at that kind of speed, can I tell you? But all I knew was, I've just got to keep holding on to this thing. Otherwise, I'm now going to be stuck in the middle of the lake and I won't be able to get back. So I just, you know, determinedly hung on to the back of the thing on the back of the boat. And then everyone laughed at me for the rest of the week. And I think that Peter probably has a similar experience of holding on to Jesus. So we know that, you know, a mere, if you've got Bibles, you can open it in Mark chapter 1. In 1:36, so this is 16 verses after he started following Jesus. This is not very long. We don't know exactly the amount of time, but, you know, it's not very long in the story. So he's just found Jesus. He's just agreed to follow him. And then we're told in 1:36 that Jesus gets up early to pray. And they're basically, they don't know that this is his practice because they've just started hanging out with him. And they can't find him. So you can imagine, you've left everything to follow Jesus and now you've lost him. You know, it's not a good start. And so they're kind of chasing around and eventually Peter tracks him down and he says, you know, everybody is looking for you. I mean, how embarrassing. You know, we've just started following you and now we've lost you. So that's very early on. And the roller coaster continues. They see healings, they see deliverance, they see Jesus saying that he can forgive people. And you can sort of get this sense of, you know, what's going on here? Something's going on here. You know, this is, you know, I imagine Peter really knew in his heart of hearts that Jesus was extraordinary. Did he know he was the Son of God at the beginning? Probably not. So it's a gradual realization that is beginning to build. Like, I actually think this person is the real deal. I really think this, you know, I think this could be it. And it gets more and more exciting. And eventually we get to the road to Caesarea Philippi, which is the passage up here, 8:27-30. And on the way, Jesus asked them, who do people say I am? They replied, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked, who do you say I am? Peter answers, you are the Christ. And this is the first time that anyone has called it. This is the first time any of the disciples have said who Jesus actually is, and it falls to Peter. And that must have been an incredible moment. You know, I saw it, I named it. And I'm recorded for all time. The road to Caesarea Philippi is famous. We know, and we know that it was Peter who says it. And yet immediately after that, we then, in 8:31, Jesus starts talking about his coming death. He then began to teach that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And then Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. And he said it to Peter. So there's this, Peter has this extraordinary experience of calling it and naming it and looking great. And then basically being told by Jesus that he is speaking with Satan's voice. Nice. You know, and that is his experience. Because he gets it right some of the time and he spectacularly gets it wrong other times. Now, does that resonate with any of us? You know, sometimes we look great, don't we? I'm doing this. I have got it all together. My house is vaguely fine. You know, here are my children, blah, blah, blah. I'm praying for people. It goes brilliantly well. Da, 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 da. And then other times we are complete failures and we feel like we're frauds. And if anyone actually knew the relationship I have with my children, the way I speak to people I love, what my house looks like. I once got taught to do prayer ministry or counselling by someone who said, if your desk isn't tidy, you should never pray for anyone. I just say that would have stopped my entire life of praying for people. Anyway, because she felt like, you know, your life wasn't in order, which is, she's probably right. My desk is a complete tip. But, you know, and so sometimes we feel like, gosh, if you only knew what I was like, you wouldn't listen to me. You know, you wouldn't really hear anything I said. And that's who we are. And we're like Peter. And we don't have to be getting it right all the time because that's not the reason Jesus picked us. He picked us because he picked us and because he sees into who we are. He sees into our hearts and he gets us and he knows us, good and bad, weak and strong, our best moments, you know, and our worst moments. He knows all about us. And I imagine if you interviewed Peter, if you did a kind of rolling documentary of Peter in the 3 years of being with Jesus, it would, you know, answers to these kind of questions would really have changed. Who's Jesus? Don't know, think he'd have known at the beginning. Why did Jesus come? What's your role? How is this discipleship likely to pan out? I think at different stages in the journey with Jesus, Peter would have answered in a very different way to all those kind of questions, because he honestly didn't exactly know what was going on for most of the time. But I think this is his one constant. I know that I know that I know that the Son of God loves me, forgives me, and takes me by the hand. And I think he probably could have said that all the way through. And I think that's probably the thing that we need to be able to say. Getting it right or wrong, doing brilliantly and getting everyone telling you that you're fantastic, or doing terribly and everyone pointing out your flaws. I know that I am loved by the Son of God, that he forgives me, that he takes me by the hand. And I think that's the key to discipleship. It doesn't matter where we've come from. It doesn't really matter what our story is. It doesn't really matter where we're going, what we've learnt or not learnt, how many times we've messed it up. We are transformed as we hold on to Jesus' hand and we begin to accept, just begin to accept, that this extraordinary, amazing, ridiculous love might be for us too. There's one of my favourite television programmes of all time is The West Wing. Who's ever seen The West Wing? The West Wing. Oh, it's great. Go get it on a box set. £50, Amazon, whole 7 series. It's really good. Anyway, it's a bit old now. But can we just, I think, yes, it might be after this. Now, just one sec. Okay, it's a really bad, I've got great visuals here. You will be, this is in English, tick. You may not be able to see the image very clearly. And this is when the president, obviously it's the West Wing, in terms of the West Wing, and the president and his middle daughter have had a massive falling out because she basically said something to the press which sort of, which put him in an awkward position politically. And he got very, very cross with her. He called her into the office. There was a big shouting match. And then he realized that actually the reason she'd done it was because she had quite a high level of faith in his sort of judgment and capacity. But they'd had this big falling out. And she said she stayed on, but she stayed on only just. And they're now watching a film together. And he is talking to her about actually how he feels about her. And I want you just so even if you can't see it, you could close your eyes and you could hear it.
Going round to the back entrance. He stopped again. He looked at his hand.
How you doing? I said, how you doing?
Fine.
You know, we're coming up to the good part.
Dad, people are trying to watch the movie.
You want to bet me your tuition no one in this room is going to shush me? I hear you're thinking about ophthalmology.
Oncology.
Why do you want to study people's feet?
That's podiatry.
And what's children's medicine?
Pediatrics.
I thought it was obstetrics.
That's pregnant women.
And what's the study of feet?
Dad, you're not going to get me to laugh.
Hmm? The only thing you ever had to do to make me happy was come home at the end of the day. Endocrinology would be what? Disorders of the gallbladder?
Thyroid.
I'm pretty sure you're wrong about that. I think endocrinology is a subspecialty of internal medicine devoted to the digestive system.
That would be gastroenterology.
Are you sure it's not nephrology, immunology, cardiology, or dermatology?
Would you stop it? I'm trying to watch the movie.
Okay. Here comes the good part.
So she, before that conversation, she says, I don't know what to do to make you happy. And he says, the only thing you ever have to do to make me happy is to come home at the end of the day. That's it. And I think that that is a tiny, tiny reflection of how God feels about us. The only thing we ever have to do to to make him happy is to turn up and be with him. It's really very straightforward. It's what grace is about. That's not to say we don't get changed. We do get changed. But you know, God has a settled attitude of grace towards us. And so some of us feel very confused right now. Some of us feel very like we've been through a bit of a war zone. We don't know very much. But we know that we want to hold God's hand. We don't know much about what's going to happen. But we know that the best way to be is to be with God. And we know that he fully knows us. We can flip onto the next slide. It's Psalm 139. It's one of my favorite psalms. And this is how much God knows you. He's searched you and he knows you. He's familiar with all your ways. You know, when you get to know people, you just get to know kind of how they're going to speak. And in fact, horribly, now that I've been married to John for nearly 23 years, I sound like him sometimes, you know. People go, oh, I can just hear him in you. It's very shocking. But I can hear myself in my children. Before a word is on our tongue, you know it completely. So you know when we have moments of brilliant wisdom and we speak them out and we'd really like everyone to have heard them. And then you know when we say things that are just completely stupid and mean and unkind and actually quite destructive. And God knows all those words. He already knows it. Before you've even put it on your tongue, before you even choose whether you're going to say it out loud or restrain yourself and hold it in, God knows what those words are. He hems us in behind and before. We can't escape him. He knows us before we were even born. He even knows the span of our lives. He knows our anxious thoughts. He knows our thoughts in our best moments when we have the most faith. And he knows our thoughts in our worst moments where we have next to no faith, when we're beset by anxiety. And we don't know where to go and we don't know how we can talk to people because we know that they've got it all together. So he knows everything about us. And he perfectly loves us. Corinthians 13:12. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then shall I know fully, even as I am fully known. Right now, you are fully known by God, and you are fully accepted by God. And anything or anyone who tells you otherwise is just lying. You're fully known, and you're fully accepted. And I can say that with absolute certainty, not because I know any of you, apart from Carol, who obviously is lovely, but because I know God, and I know what his promise is over us. So we're going to stand now, and we're going to pray. So it might be good to close your eyes so you don't get distracted by me wandering around or other people around you. If you want to, you can hold out your hands. It's not magic, but it's just a sign we're open. We want God to come and meet us. We're going to ask him to come and just show us again his attitude over us. He fully knows us. He fully chose us. And he sees who we are. And Holy Spirit, we just invite you to come now. Just rest on each one of us. I think there are people here who are still slightly unsure if God would actually want to take them by the hand. You kind of know it in your head. You don't always know it in your heart. So you kind of hope that if you run with the crowd, you just get scooped up anyway. And God says he picks you out and he chooses you specifically and individually to hold your hand. there's some of us here who feel we've probably let go of God's hand, or we're holding on just by our fingertips. And we really know, we know that the best place to be is in his presence. But for whatever reason, we've tried to work out slightly different ways of doing it. And God says, just come back, it's all right. Just come back, here's my hand. Lay hold of my hand. Spirit, we just invite you to rest on us now. Fill our hearts and minds. And where our hearts can become quite anxious and just holding on to things, I think God replaces that with his love and his peace. And it is supernatural because it's outside of our understanding. So what we're going to do now is we're going to pray specifically for people. And I would invite you, just there's lots of ministry teams, so just come to the front now. You know you want to. If any of those things that I was talking about, or you just like prayer, then we're going to pray for you.